Then when I started graduate school, I had Q-Turitin, T-U-R-I-T-T-I-N. He was a mathematician, and Stephen Arshavsky. I'll spell it for you here. W-A-R-S-C-H-A-W-S-K-I. Stephen Arshavsky is a mathematician. And all these people, I think, had a profound effect on me, as a matter of fact, because I discovered more and more often I was trying to act like them, as a matter of fact. And they had extremely high standards, and I had lots of chaps like that, and lots of women in high school, and even a woman teacher in junior high school that I had for 3 years, who really knew how to teach, you know. But the prevailing thing with all these people was they all had high standards and were good teachers. That was the prevailing thing that had an effect on me. I had some lousy ones also. When I was in high school, I had a semester that was taught by the football coach that was an absolute disaster, you know. And we had a chap at St. Paul's Central High School who offered the physics, who had just been there too long, that's all. And I know we had a fellow who was in social sciences. I can't even remember his name, but he was just awful. Shouldn't have been in a high school at all. But I had so many good ones that those other ones really didn't bother me very much. I was lucky.
You think that they are also responsible for developing a sense of independent thinking?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, they were. I mean, I can remember Molly Hyde, for example. She really challenged the students. Even in high school, she challenged the students. You know, mathematics is awfully easy to offer by rote. You know, it's very easy to offer it that way. But getting to think about something like that is a much harder job, and she was able, Mary Schoberg and Posner and all those people, the same thing, they were very good. Harold Swanson, that I had when I was a freshman, he really forced you to think, gave excruciatingly hard homework problems. We had to figure out, you just couldn't fill up the paper with it. So I was, I had a lot of very good people. I had some bad ones, but they were very good. I learned a lot from them.
During your undergraduate work at Minnesota, still the Depression.
33 to 37.
I was going to ask you about what effect you saw that within the university, maybe you weren't aware of it as a student, and also the kinds of facilities and equipment and so on that were prevailing in the departments.
Well, I would say that even the undergraduate students could see that most of the engineering laboratories, the equipment was antique. I mean, even undergraduates could see that. I mean, the stuff that was in chemical engineering labs, of which there were three, I think we took, on the whole, was not very good. It was really old stuff, most of which not only didn't work, but was awfully dangerous. Okay. We had to take things like mechanical engineering labs, and that stuff, some of those old steam engines and pumps, things like that that engineers were forced to undergo was very, very old and antique stuff, and the students all include that. Chemistry labs was largely non-instrumental, okay? I mean, you perform most of the experiments in flasks and beakers and test tubes and that sort of thing, so it's not really like it is now, for example, where all these labs are highly instrumented, even at the undergraduate. At that time, there wasn't anything. I don't remember seeing, as an undergraduate, a single pH meter, for example. What about physical chemistry lab? Was that? Well, those were you did the Victor Meyer thing. You had to have the Victor Meyer apparatus in order to determine molecular weight of a gas. You had that, okay? You had things like piscosimeters, for example, and the like, but many of the experiments that you had performed determining solubilities, for example, potassium iodate or a lot of things like that were really things that required very little in the way of instrumentation. All the balances were chain-o-matics at that time, for example. It was a standard thing, it was a chain-o-matic balance. And even that, in some cases, in analytical chemistry, was kind of a luxury, where the very first experiment you had performed was rate all the weights. Okay.
Had you given much thought, as you were approaching the end of your undergraduate career, had you given much thought as to what you wanted to do?
Oh yeah, I wanted to stay in school, as a matter of fact. I mean, that was one of the things that I thought of, and I had accepted, or I had looked into going to MIT, and I looked into going to Purdue, and I'd even looked in, for some reason, I'd go to Georgia Tech, okay? And something happened in the spring of that senior year that I suddenly decided, no, I'm going to take a job, and I don't know what happened. You know, I can't think of any single incident. One of the things that actually turned me off was that all these people were very discouraging about how long it was going to take to get a doctor's degree. They all talked about 6 and 7 years, okay? And at age a little over 20, that seemed to be a bit much, okay? That was one thing that shut me off. The other thing, I think the thought of having lived through the Depression and suddenly getting a job offer for $130 a month almost seemed like the end of the world. That's what I got when I started. When I started to work for Exxon in Baton Rouge, I got $130 a month.
Did you interview many companies before?
Oh, I interviewed probably a half a dozen. I interviewed a half a dozen. I interviewed DuPont Company, and somebody asked me what I thought about going back to school, and I, in a rash moment, said, well, it would be something I would certainly have to think about, and that killed me with respect to that job. See, I said I was very keen, you know, and not very sophisticated. I'd hardly been out of the city, you know, so it was and I can remember interviewing Allied Chemical and Dye at that time. National Anilin was, as a matter of fact. And I remember interviewing a sugar refinery, I think, in a starch refinery or something in Illinois or Iowa. And I interviewed, I think, U.S. Steel or
Exxon.
Why did I choose Exxon? Well, I can remember why I chose Exxon. I can remember just exactly. Was that there was a fellow who was in the class of 1936 who had gone there. And there was also a fellow who was in the class of 1938 who had gone there for the summer of 1936. And I had spoken to them, and they all said when after they got finished, that's where they were going to go. And I went there largely because I thought that at least there's going to be somebody that I know. Okay. So that was why I went there.
And that was in Baton Rouge?
That was in Baton Rouge. I went there in, I would say, probably the last week of June of 1937. I can remember leaving St. Paul with a heavy suit on and getting into Baton Rouge when the temperature was 97, the humidity was 97, I almost expired.
What were you, what did you do at Exxon?
Well, they started out everybody in kind of a 3 months educational program. And in that group I went to, I think there were nine of us in the group. There were two from MIT and two from Purdue and one from Oklahoma, two from Minnesota, as I recall. I can't remember where the others were from, one from Case. And for 3 months, they just kind of shuffled us around, okay, learning things. And then after the third month, they assigned us. We didn't have a choice of what we wanted to do. We got assigned. And I got assigned up to the yard office, it was called. That was an office which was out in the refinery. And we were called process control engineers, is what we were called. I think that of that nine, six of us went out to the yard office, which was out in the center of that big refinery. And we joined probably four or five people who had been there from 1 to 4 or 5 years. We were each assigned some area of the refinery where we were supposed to worry about being a process control engineer. Now, it was a very ill-defined job, but the essential thing is, you have to remember now, this is 1937. It's really still the depth of depression. Within the refinery, there's very little construction of any kind, and everybody is concerned about saving money. So the object of the enterprise I was involved in was to see how can you improve operations in order to save money. It was one where you spent your time looking for steam leaks and phenol losses and wasted water, and how could you make the units much more thermally efficient, for example. You ran tests on heat exchangers, for example, to see how often they should be cleaned, okay? And it was really a job where you had to justify your existence. Okay, if you didn't save any money and you couldn't show it, you weren't doing a very good job. Okay, and I had three units that I was responsible for. One was an old Kellogg distillation unit of very old vintage. One was a phenol extraction unit for lubricating oil. That was a seven-stage unit. And the other was a phenol extraction unit for lubricating oil that was a column unit. Exxon in its lubricating oil program used anhydrous phenol to extract non-paraffinic things from oil. So the raffinate was much higher in paraffins than the extract was. Okay. So used anhydrous phenol for that. And what you did is you actually juggled the temperature, so you were about 10 degrees below heat miscibility. And I had to, I followed engineering on those three units and was up to me for example. The biggest job that I had was to figure out how to stop all the phenol losses, because they used to lose 8,000 gallons a week. Okay. And that was the sort of job it was. And it was impossible to find out where the damn phenol went. Some of it went in the air, obviously, and some went down the sewer, but you could only find about 10% of it that way, and no one knew where the rest of it went. And I had that for almost exactly 21 months I had that. And then during the, and at that time, really the general supervision of all of us was not very good, and there was really a lot of discontent, and I decided I'd leave, and I went back to the university.
That was 1939.
That was 1939. That was September of 1939. I went back to the university, and I had written in probably July or August. I had written the university so to see whether I could get a teaching assistantship or something. And finally, when I was about to give up for some reason or other, I got an offer to be a teaching assistant in the mathematics department.
Had you applied to the math?
No, I didn't apply to any place. I'd just written up there and said, you know, I'd be interested in coming. And all of a sudden, I got this letter from the old chap who's department chairman. And much to my chagrin, I showed up there about September 28th. I found I was going to teach college algebra and higher algebra, and that was a shock to me, because I started then too, okay, and that was really kind of daunting.
Okay, come back.
And but I
so you were to give all the lectures and everything on that?
Did all the, it was 5 hours for each of them, and you had to do all your own grading. It was slave labor raised to a very high power, okay? That's the way they operated in that engineering department I'm talking about. That was a separate mathematics department, that's it. Okay, so you did all your own work, and at the same time you were supposed to be prosecuting your own graduate program. And as a matter of fact, I liked it.
I had read someplace that you had actually started taking some math courses at night while you were at Exxon. Is that
yes,
true?
In the second year that I was there, it would have been the year starting the fall of 38, there were four other fellows who were in the process engineering department, and I went over to the university, and we said we'd like to take something. Okay. Well, in the evening at that time at LSU, they didn't offer very much, but One of the fellows found out that there was a chap in the mathematics department who would offer something in differential equations. And his name was Rutt, Norman Rutt, R-U-T-T. And he was a very fine chap, very gentle man. And he offered us, five of us, a special thing where he only got the fees. He did it just for the fees, but of course, once again, we're still in depression. He was happy to give me extra money. And I would say that's probably the thing that really sparked my interest in mathematics more than anything else. And then when I got the offer to go to the mathematics department, that, you know, kind of reinforced itself. Rutt was a fellow that was also kind of a role model. We went through that the whole spring of that year. Would have been the spring of 38, I think.
I'm not clear. When you went back to Minnesota in 39, you got your MS in 41. I'm not clear whether it was in math or chemical engineering.
Chemical engineering.
It wasn't chemical engineering.
When I was in the mathematics department, when I showed up as a TA, there was another fellow who showed up as a young assistant professor at the same time. His name was Hurt. Okay, Hurritin. And he and I developed a relationship, and therefore I decided to work for him for a doctor's degree, eventually, not at that time. And I was trying to figure out something to do for a thesis, and I discovered a little problem on my own. And I worked it up, and he helped me. And then I offered that to the chemical engineering department as a thesis for the master's degree. Okay? And there was a hell of a big discussion because they had never had a non-experimental thesis at any level. So there was a big discussion whether it was really the appropriate thing for somebody to offer an analytical solution of a problem at the master's degree, but they finally they came to the MS.
Was that the one that was responsible for your first paper on?
That's right. That's the first one.
The main
very first one. That's why Matrix methods. That's the very first one. I'll give you a reprint if you want.
That would be great. Thank you. I noticed that as you just said, there was a tremendous debate of whether they would accept it. But as I recall, I'm looking at that paper somewhere. You actually had to explain basic matrix methods before you ever went
into
it.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
Because this was
almost unknown at that time. That's right, yeah.
But engineers then didn't have any exposure to matrix methods.
No. You see, chemical engineering, I would say, until about the latter part of the 1940s, and longer than that in all kinds of universities, was a completely non-mathematical subject. It was much more chemical than it was mathematical. If you went to Purdue or Illinois or Minnesota, any of those schools, engineering was non-analytical. Okay, it was not an analytical subject at all. All theses were experimental theses. My general view when I came back to university, now we're talking about I was in chemical engineering in 1939. I was in there in 1940, most of 1941, as a matter of fact. And I began to think over and over and over again that this was not the kind of scholarly activity that I had thought I was going to get into. I lost my interest in I think I'd say I had lost my interest in chemical engineering and the things that I wasn't interested in determining heat transfer, mass transfer, and all that kind of stuff. And after I got that master's, then I became a doctor's candidate in the fall of 1941 for a degree in mathematics. And I was the first one who wanted to use somebody as an advisor who wasn't in the other department. Okay? I wanted to use the fellow that had shown up in the hall, Hugh Hurt, and I wanted him to serve as the advisor, and therefore that's what I did. But there was a big discussion about that, because there was a fellow who was in the pure mathematics department, his name was Jackson, who had been a long time ago a very distinguished mathematician, and he had had every single doctoral student in mathematics at the University of Minnesota that had ever been given, and I was the first one to decide not to work for him. And that was really a shock. It almost didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Who did you have to convince the most?
Well, you had to convince somebody over in the graduate school, and you had to convince people in the mathematics department, even some people in your own department. The department chairman there wasn't sure that he could allow me to work with somebody there. You know, it was a much more authoritarian kind of operation than exists almost any place. Now, people could shake your head like that and you were all done. You know, you didn't have any recourse.
I'm curious about how you managed to devise this problem for your master's thesis on your own. Did you have any... You said your math background was almost limited until you took these courses.
Yeah. Well, this problem, in the fall of 1939, I was taking some chemical engineering courses, and you know, there's a general problem that every student in chemical engineering has to look at. He always worked on distillation, okay? And there was a thing called McCabe-Thielen. What I discovered was, I think I can solve that from an analytical point of view, and that's the problem that I solved. I discovered how to use the finite difference mathematics and matrices, how to solve that problem. Most of the mathematics having been learned after I came back in the fall of 39. So I solved a little chemical engineering problem analytically that no one had ever solved before.
How did the